I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr, and welcome to Justice by Design, the podcast that takes a look at the issues that are most pressing in our society and talks to the people who are rolling up their sleeves and finding real solutions to them. And before we get to today's podcast, I would like to ask you a favor. If you have found this podcast on a search or if a friend forwarded it to you, follow us. Follow us wherever you get your podcast, because that helps other people find us too. And if you want a little more out of it, go to YouTube and go to our channel, Justice by Design, and subscribe there. It's absolutely free, and it's just another way to engage in these conversations. So I really appreciate you for doing that. Well, you know, we're talking about justice, and usually when justice happens, it means that something has gone wrong. When there are calls for justice, it means something has gone wrong, a tragedy, a disaster, a crime. And usually those things don't just happen in abstraction. They harm people. There are people who are feeling the repercussions and sometimes having their entire lives turned upside down in an instant. And they have to deal with so much, including often an onslaught of media. We've seen that, whether it's the disasters in the wake of Hurricane Helene, or whether it's one of what seems now countless high-profile abusers who are facing justice but need the survivors of that awful abuse to come forward and give their voices to ensure that justice is done. So who helps those folks? Well, that's what I want to talk about today with a friend of mine and also the founder of an organization called Survivors Say, David Guarino. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Kim. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really glad to talk to you about this. Well, first of all, I'm just glad to talk to you. We've known each other 20 plus years. We used to work together at the Boston Herald, at the Massachusetts yep. State House during the Romney administration. Mm-hmm. That seems so long mm-hmm. ago now.
But... a long, many lives ago.
But we're both journalists, so we know what it's like to do our job when there is some scandal or disaster or trial right. or awful crime. But you started this organization to help folks on the other side of it. Tell us a little bit about that origin story.
Sure. And thanks again for having me, and thanks for these discussions and all that you do. We were founded officially 3 years ago. The work started long before that. Like a lot of people, I transitioned from journalism into working in public relations. I worked in state government, managing communications for politicians for a little while in Massachusetts. And along the way, you sort of find yourself helping people when the need arises, right? Like any other industry, if your friend is a plumber and you've got a problem, you call them, you know, and a doctor's getting constant, you know, requests from friends. When you're in this world, if you have a friend who's in trouble, it gets a little, you know, serious real quick. And we found that there were times when people would ask us, can you help me out? I've got this friend who's gone through this tragedy. They've got the media knocking on their door. Fast forward to the Boston Marathon bombing. And we saw in our backyard an incident of terror where a bunch of people were suddenly thrust into the media spotlight. And that really sort of focused my thinking around this gap in services which exists. You know, there's so many services out there for people who are going through the worst moments of their lives. But one of them, as you said in the intro, that's missing is helping them manage the media. They're in these traumatic moments. They're surrounded by a lot of support and love, but the media is knocking on their door, and we deeply respect the work that the media does. It's important. We want to start with that. But these families, most of whom don't have the resources to hire a lawyer or have a friend who happens to be someone who can speak for them, need some support. And that's where we come in.
And it's really great that you have that background in journalism as a reporter, you know, to help them. And I mean, I was thinking myself in my job, I have been called to at times talk to people when they are sure. at their worst. I mean, I started yeah. my very first journalism job was actually at the Boston Globe, and I started the first week of September 2001. So
Oh my goodness.
by the second week, I was, because two of those planes left from Boston Logan Airport, we had to talk to a number of people who were grieving because they lost people on those planes. And I remember knocking on those doors, and just sometimes it was too much, and sometimes they were angry. Sometimes, they invited me in, and I was sitting at their kitchen table, and they were showing me pictures of their loved one. But that had to have been hard, and they were dealing with that by themselves with no one to help them. Talk a little bit about why it is important for them to have the support that Survivor Say provides.
And I remember it as a reporter is you get good at it, right? And you sort of scare yourself as a human being. You knock on that door, you know you have to knock on the door or make the call or whatever, because you can't go back to the newsroom without it. But you have this sort of rap that you get down and you get good at it. And you kind of sometimes I remember hoping that the families would toss me off the porch and say, "No, we don't want to talk to you." But sometimes they'd let me in and we'd have a really rich conversation. And long term, one of our goals is to sort of change that paradigm a little bit to say the stories that are written are going to be written anyway. But so often because the families don't want to or can't, sort of articulate their feelings, they tend to just be about the tragedy that happened. And what we've tried to start to do is make them also about the broader life of this person if they were killed, for instance. But that's sort of the work that we get into when we get started. It's first and foremost deciding with the family, with the survivors, what do they want their approach to be with the media. Some of them are eager to get out and tell their story, and we want to support them in doing that. They want the stories that are told about their loved one, if there's a tragedy, to include more material about their life and include who they are and the legacy they leave. Some of them honestly just want privacy and they want the media, kind of kept away. And we don't, we take that responsibility seriously. And the reporters we've worked with understand, and they say, okay, we respect that and what they want. And from your reporting is they want to know that you're speaking from the family's perspective, that you're saying, we respectfully have no comment, but we'll let you know when we do. And then they kind of, go about their day and do their work anyway. But they have one of the things we found from the journalism side is that reporters really appreciate it because they can be, frankly, more transactional with somebody like me, right? They know that I know the media and I know the work that you're doing and I respect it. But they can also say, "Hey, can we get a photo of this person, or can we get this or that?" The things that you always need, and you don't want to ask a family member that. So asking me feels a little bit more comfortable, And I think that was a surprise to me, as I thought some reporters would be a little standoffish and say, "Oh, you're a PR person in the middle of this." And in these cases, I'm not working for a politician. I'm not working for a business leader or somebody like I do in my other day job. I'm working for a family that has really been through a lot. And so reporters meet us with a lot of understanding, which is really nice.
Yeah, one thing that I thought was great in looking at the work that Survivor Say does is what you call changing the narrative around survivors of some sort of crisis. Because often you do see, particularly in one of these awful high profile crimes where it's, we've, Diddy or Harvey Weinstein or something like that, Bill Cosby. Initially, there is this sort of pushback, like, oh, there's just, they're just trying to take this guy down and these people just want money. And suddenly, people who have survived something horrific are now seen as a villain in some way, even. But they're also necessary, a necessary part of the process to bring this powerful person to justice. So how do you change that narrative in that case when, in the glare of the media, and again, particularly against people who do have a lot of resources and power?
People with power, right? And we've found ourselves, we're almost entirely volunteer organization. We have sort of one part-time student intern kind of person working for us that we're paying. But and so the resources, are sometimes, a challenge. And there we've been in cases where there's a high powered, legal team and PR team that's working on behalf of another individual. And so that's a reality that we have to face. I think, the biggest thing that we found is, especially these folks who are being thrust into the spotlight, don't have the sort of knowledge of years of working in the media and how it works. So a lot of it is just educating the survivors about here's how the media works, and here's how you can advocate for yourself, and making sure on the front end that, they know they don't, there's no requirement that they speak to the media, but here's what happens if you choose to, and making sure they're aware going in. But once you're out there telling your story, especially as a survivor of sexual assault or violence, you then can become, as you've seen, fodder for the grist mill, and people are going to say all sorts of things. And so making sure that we first empower the survivors to with knowledge and of how sort of how this all can work. There's no absolutes. But then really, I find I'm surprised every time we work on one of these cases just how good storytellers are deeply compassionate, and reporters come at their work, good reporters especially, but without bias, without prejudgments, but they recognize in the folks that we've worked with are survivors who've gone through, unspeakable tragedies. And they approach these survivors with a level of compassion and understanding in how they ask questions and how they approach things, and then how they cover the story, in a way that debunks a lot of the myths that are out there about journalists, and I think that knowing that going in, and that if you do the work on the front end to make sure the reporter's coming at it from a respectful story perspective, and we'll listen and we'll talk about what we're doing, that can start to change the narrative. It doesn't mean that you go stand on the steps of a New York City courthouse and try to do a press conference and control that, but you do individual one-on-ones and are more selective with your reporters, because that's the best way to both protect the survivor in some way, but also help them achieve their narrative of, and achieve their goals through the narrative.
Yeah, Dave, I think that's so important because I think a lot of times PR people or communication strategists get a bad rap as, trying to spin something or trying to, manage people. But it really, when done properly and done from the point of view that you and the other folks at Survivor Say are, it's really valuable, not just to the people, but also to journalists and therefore the public. When I'm coming in hot on September 12th and knocking on somebody's door, I'm thinking, okay, this person, I'm worried. Like, I don't want to ask something. I realize this person's probably still in shock. I'm not a psychologist. I don't want to do damage to them, but I also need this story and all that. If you have someone who's managing them, who is aware of all of that, who is helping them to say, listen, if you don't want to talk now, we can do it at a different time. And then you can still get that story, that very important human element, to which is important to tell any story, but do it in a way that doesn't cause harm, that doesn't, further traumatize them. But that is still doing justice in that way. And I just think that that is really extraordinary. Can you talk about some success stories that you've seen, what having an advocate like that in the media space, how that's made a difference for a survivor?
Sure. No, you're totally right. And one thing, to just say before I get to your question is, newsrooms are becoming more aware of this, right? And I think that there we found that I don't know your whole experience, but mine was, you walk in a newsroom, you give it a notebook, and maybe you have a recorder, and you're sent off. And I think newsrooms are getting better at acknowledging that there's trauma that is inflicted on the reporters, and that they are going through stuff, and that in helping with trauma-informed training, especially for these cop reporters that are out there, to make sure that they know, okay, here's how trauma affects the brain. Here's the people you're going to be interviewing, that kind of thing. But to get to your question, and I'll try to be as brief as I can. But one story I like to tell, and we just did a panel discussion with this individual, is the story of Rhonda LaRock. And Rhonda was one of the victims of the Las Vegas mass shooting back in 2017 at the concert, the Route 91 Harvest Festival. She's from Massachusetts. She was there with her husband, her father, and her daughter. And she was one of the people killed that night. And we were just in the process of thinking about starting the nonprofit. And someone who I had talked to about it happened to know the family through her work, through Rhonda's work. And we got connected with the family right away. And it was really the first case that we worked on from almost, within hours after the shooting, through her the family returning from Las Vegas, through the lead up to the wake and the funeral and memorial service and a public statement that they read. And it was a lot, right? And the first thing that we did was you really try to establish a trust with the family, right? There's a lot of people coming out of the woodwork to say, I want to help you, and here's who I am. So one of the things that is really important to us is being referred in through a trusted referral source. We don't go and knock on anybody's door in the middle of a trauma. We're not doing that. And so in this case, it was someone in government who said, hey, you need some help with the media, Dave can help. And so that was good. And we established that trust. And then as the family was coming back, we issued a statement on their behalf. And so we had already been able to figure out all the reporters that were covering this. And the statement didn't really, frankly, say much, it went from a moment of the reporters all on the street outside their house and calling them and trying to find them through social media to coming right to me. And it immediately took that pressure off, and we had to manage the media calls, and we're happy to do it. But it took that pressure off of like reporters on your door. It's like, okay, now it's a manageable situation. And then the day of the wake and the funeral, the family decided that they wanted to issue a statement, and we talked to them about the benefits of that and kind of doing a press conference kind of statement without questions, though. And we set it up at the Tewksbury Police Department. They're from Tewksbury, Massachusetts, and told the reporters that, this person's going to come in, he's going to issue a statement, he's not going to take any questions. And the reporters are like, great, as long as we're not missing anything, we're good. Go through that. The reporters were all pleased. They got what they wanted. The family was pleased. And I remember the Tewksbury police chief looked at me and said, well, that went really well. I've been doing this for 30 years. These things don't always go so well. And I said, well, that's because the reporters knew what they were going to get. There was no confusion. It was controlled in a way that was calm, and everyone sort of was doing what they did, and off they went. So that, I think, is a good example of where you can bring a sense of calm and rationalness to a totally, chaotic situation. And the family was pleased with it. They were able to say what they wanted to say, but also, maintain their privacy to some extent as they were mourning and protect their daughter, which was their primary goal. So those are sort of the big moments where I think we can be most useful when there's a high profile tragedy. And we're often asked, how do you define high profile? Well, it's up to the media, really. It's not. As there can be a shooting in the streets in Boston that doesn't even make the news anymore sometimes, right?
Right.
It's not necessarily high profile, but something like this obviously is. And it can last for 20 minutes, or it can last for, weeks and weeks up to a trial. So
Yeah. Or even
we sort of go where
longer.
the
I
need is.
mean, we're still writing about, I mean, I think just last year, I'm still writing something about the Boston Marathon,
Of course.
based on court appeals and things like that. And every single time, one thing I think about when I do reach out to someone involved, it's like, you know, the family has to go through this again and again and again every time this comes up. And so
every anniversary, every,
yeah,
they get those calls, you know, and sometimes they want to participate and sometimes they don't.
They do. You know, it's interesting that you said you were referred to folks. I wanted to ask you about that. It's not just a matter of, it's not you reaching out, but it's not also, it's also not just family members or others reaching out to you. You said it's other people in government, police, other folks reach out to you. Talk a little more about that.
Yeah, and that's something that we're really trying to work on, you know, is making sure that the folks who are, because of the nature of their job, are going to be working with families and survivors, know we exist when they need us. And so it's a lot of folks in law enforcement, you know, DAs, police chiefs, their, you know, their departments. They have this wonderful system, I'm sure you've seen in your work, of victim witness advocates, and they just do incredible work. And they work with these survivors and their families from the minute there's a crime and a legal case that follows, through all of it, you know, and a former victim witness advocate is on our board now. And she's just helped me so much understand what they do. And many times there's a lot of help that they can provide, but this is one of those areas where if it's a high profile case, they feel like it's typically just a little bit beyond what they would normally do. They're focused on the court process and preparing the family for statements and things like that. So that's a key referral source. Government leaders, mayors, you know, elected officials, hospital folks, ministers, religious folks, you know, community-based organizations, you name it. Those are the folks who we really have been spending a lot of time trying to make sure that that they're aware that that we exist. And every time we have a meeting with one of them, they say, "Oh gosh, I wish you were here 2 years ago when we had this tragedy and someone we knew, you know." And so that just reminds us of why we need to be there when you know, when the time strikes. In the other side of it is people who want to step out of the shadows a little bit and tell their stories. We, you know, you mentioned a lot of this, you know, sort of sexual assault survivors who've stepped forward, human trafficking survivors, others who, you know, because the media protects their identity, are not sort of subjected to the same level of inquiry while these cases are going on, which is wonderful. But sometimes they want to tell their story, right? They want to step out. And so we work with them quite a bit to, okay, be prepared for this. Here's what, here's how to think about maybe coming forward. Also folks who, because the media can be fickle, the, you know, the media isn't covering their story and they want more attention to it, you know, missing persons cases, unsolved homicides, things like that, where we work to sort of draw the media toward a case and say, hey, you should pay attention to this or advocate for finding, you know, finding the killer or something like that.
That's so important because we see that a lot. We see cases or, you know, as a reporter, I'm sure this happened with you too. You get, you know, notes in your email about something and, you know, I can pass it on to the news desk, but there are often, there is a clear, I won't say a perceived inequity in how big crimes are covered. There's a real one. If you're, you know, if somebody is a missing person or a victim of crime and they happen to be from a high, you know, a fancy area for a certain affluence, or if they're white, I mean, you know, I live in Washington, D.C. I remember a case, a horrific case of a woman who was killed on the street. She was mugged and she was killed. And it was all over the news. And I think this happens a lot in other communities and it doesn't get this kind of coverage.
No, they call it, you know, missing white woman syndrome, right? Let's call it what it is.
Yes.
And we see, you know, we see these cases all the time, and where we spend a lot of our time is making sure that we're there in the communities that need us most, right? You know, there are plenty of high profile crimes. And as I said in the beginning, a lot of those in wealthier suburbs where if there's a crime, it tends to draw more media interest because it's more unusual, right? Mm-hmm. How many times as reporters did we say to people, well, we don't write about the planes that land safely. That's just the nature of the business. But those folks have advocates, right? Those folks have means to hire a lawyer or hire a PR person. That's fine. We're good with that. In the communities that are disproportionately impacted by violence, they're also disproportionately unable to have access to a lot of these services, right? So we work to spend a lot of time making sure that that's where we are. So we're, Massachusetts, in Roxbury, in Mattapan, in Springfield, where we were involved, where there's a police involved shooting, we were with the family, things like that, where there's just fewer services that are available and fewer access to services when they need them.
So, Dave, what advice would you give somebody finds themselves suddenly in the middle of a crisis and their lives are upended and they have all of these new things to navigate, including the press? What should they do?
Call us. No. I think that the biggest things that we say to people right out of the gate is to think about, number one, finding someone really close to you that you trust, that you have a deep relationship with before this thing happened, and asking them to help you manage the media. We work very closely with the folks, parents of someone who's been killed or loved ones. But I often try to say to them, don't you be the person that I'm dealing with every minute of every day. Give me a cousin or a brother or somebody who's just a step removed so that you can sort of stay focused, and then they can bring issues to you as we decide that that's important. So having someone, just anyone who can be on your side, who you trust implicitly. The other thing that I say is pretty quickly try to figure out what you want to do with your social media accounts. The media is very good, in my experience, at asking permission to use photos that are on somebody's individual Facebook page or things like that. But you never know, right? And there's a lot of websites out there. Everybody's a reporter now, right? We've all seen it. So what the Globe might do, or the Washington Post or TV might do, is very different than what a random online Facebook community or blogger might do. So I think thinking about either shutting that down or being okay with the photos that are publicly available, and related to that, one of the biggest things we've seen is be careful if you don't want stuff out there with what you're putting on some like GoFundMe. There was a family we worked with in Chelsea, which is just adjacent to Boston, and there was a baby who died in a really tragic way, and the mother was charged, and we were working with the father, and he didn't want a lot of coverage. He didn't want photos of his baby out there, and then suddenly they launched a GoFundMe page, and through no fault of their own, the media sees that as public domain, and so the next day that baby's photo was on the front of the Globe Metro page, and it's like, not the Globe's fault. That's fair use. But so thinking about things like that right out of the gate are probably the most important.
Well, this is such important work, and it's something that people don't
Thank
think
you.
about. A lot of people don't have to think about until they have to think about it.
Right.
But it's really important to have organizations like this, giving them that assistance and helping them navigate the media and the crisis more broadly. Dave Guarino, thank you so much for joining me on Justice by Design.
Thank you, Kim. Thanks for having me.
I think about being a reporter for so many years, and it's a job where you can get really, jaded and cynical very easily. But even after I left the Herald, I came across Dave again in a professional capacity because he was helping out, just volunteering to help out folks who were dealing with unspeakable tragedies, just help them navigate the press. And I was really grateful for that work. And, we don't always think about that. We don't always think of what a family is going through when we see their faces on a screen or we see that quote from them in a newspaper. But it's a lot. But giving them space to be able to use their voices and speak their truth to the public is often a crucial aspect of getting to justice. That's how we know how things affect ordinary Americans when you have someone who is explaining how they got through one of the worst and most traumatic experiences of their life so that they can urge change to protect others from something similar. That's how we hold powerful people accountable in cases where, unless a survivor comes forward and gives their testimony, not just in court, but often in public, that justice can't be found. So we really need those voices to be told, as Dave said, when such survivors want to tell them. But it's good to have support for them too. The bad guys tend to have a lot of support, but we need to make sure that we're protecting the good guys. Thank you for joining me for another episode of Justice by Design. Don't forget to follow us wherever you get your podcasts if you are not doing that already. And you can catch me on YouTube at the Justice by Design channel too. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.